You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Bergner is no stranger to risk. Research for his last two books took him to Louisiana's Angola prison and to war-torn Sierra Leone. A different kind of risk is the focus of his latest book, The Other Side of Desire. It looks into how we become who we are sexually through the erotic lives of four people whose sex drives take them far beyond the boundaries prescribed by society. A pedophile, a sadist, a foot fetishist, and a man attracted to amputees. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm pleased that it brings Daniel Bergner, who in his day job is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, back to the show. Welcome.
Thanks, Leonard. It's great to be back on.
What got you thinking about exploring this subject?
I guess I wanted to look at the way we're made sexually, at what we do with that, about the relationship between lust and love, between the physical and the spiritual. And I thought that by looking at extremes, by looking at four fairly dramatic stories of lust and love, I could then look back inward at the center.
Of course, there are all sorts of other kinky sexual preferences that you ignored. I'm not going to even mention them because people get upset. They may get upset hearing about the four that we're discussing today, in fact.
They may. I just think it's important to stress that what I was trying to illuminate was really the universal within us. I think, you know, Freud has fallen into tremendous disfavor over recent decades, but one thing he knew for certain was that the erotic is this central force within us, no matter what we do with it, you know, tamp it down, push it to the side, live with it consciously. It's there, and this was my way to look straight at it.
And to think, well, would I do that?
I think less to think, would I do that, as in would I do what these four figures are drawn to do, as to think about why they are drawn to do what they do, because of that, of course, that just reflects back on why any of us are compelled by the erotic forces that we're driven by.
But that works on the other side as well. In your introduction, you say that the child soldiers in Sierra Leone or the felons in Louisiana you interviewed in your other books all ask you the same question. Why are you here with me? And so it's not just you asking the question. They're asking the question, why are you interested in this?
Sure, because they're feeling their difference. But hopefully by the time we're done talking, and of course that talking takes place over years, there's a kind of mutual understanding, a connection. And indeed, sometimes I feel that, strange as these stories are, that I was writing autobiographically through them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to gain their trust. In some cases, we're talking about criminal activity. In other cases, the kind of activity most people are not willing to admit to.
Right. And maybe I should just try to encapsulate, at the risk of sounding really strange, one of the stories. And that's the last of the four, the one that I think of as the love story. And in it, Ron, an advertising executive who puts together the most conventional campaigns with the most conventionally gorgeous women, feels absolutely nothing for them, has always been drawn by the strange substitution that's occurred to women who are amputees. He meets a woman, Laura, lovely, bright, who never felt she was going to go beyond high school, indeed doesn't, is in a horrific car accident and loses both her legs. They meet and fall in love. And with her as his muse, he lets go of the advertising, starts becoming an art photographer in a way that I think really has the power to change the way we see. And she goes back to school and becomes what she's always wanted to be, which is working in psychology, counseling the mentally ill. It's a story that sounds improbable, but at the end, for me, brings together desire and love in this beautiful way.
Well, her accident had ended her physical relationship with her husband, so he really is almost an answer to her prayer, isn't it?
It's as though they're destined to meet. I felt really lucky to have stumbled onto their story, and again, it just calls into question, you know, how we think about beauty, how we think about the beginnings of love. I was once at a dinner party and someone asked me kind of challengingly, well, is his love pure? And I thought, well, what does that mean? Do we want love to be unconditional? Do we want it to be separated completely from the physical? And of course, my answer is yes, his love is as pure as any of our loves. It begins in the physical and becomes something deeper.
Have you spoken to any of the women amputees who are the objects of the desires of men like Ron?
Many. And there's
and does it work the other way? Are there women who are as obsessed by male amputees?
There are some, and I think there are two questions on the table. One is about the differences between men and women when it comes to what's called paraphilias, that is, desires that lie outside of the norm. The other is, in this specific case, some female amputees are very wary of men like Ron, feel that they're predatory, and others, like Laura...
And they're being objectified, aren't
they? Exactly. They're being objectified, and yet, are they really being objectified any more than any of us are, or is it only the difference that sort of highlights that physical aspect?
Well, my first reaction is to see Ron as something similar to the men who would have women's feet bound in China, because that made them dependent, that that took away a certain amount of their freedom. And there's something, I don't know whether it's controlling or a need to be there and help somebody who is in a bad situation. I'm not exactly sure how I would explain it, but in all cases, it makes me feel slightly uneasy.
And I think this book will make readers
feel... I mean, bound feet make me feel very uneasy.
Agreed. And I think the book will make readers feel, on the one hand, slightly uneasy, but I think that's because the erotic realm makes all of us slightly uneasy. And I just hope that at one level deeper than that uneasiness will come a kind of illumination.
But there is a difference between being attracted to a blonde or somebody who has a certain kind of an hourglass figure, let's say, and being attracted to somebody who has no legs.
I want to acknowledge that there may be a difference for the very reasons you say. Is there a suggestion of being attracted to helplessness? Is there a suggestion of a desire for violence? But on the other hand, I want to point out, is there really a difference? I wonder about that, or is it again a question of our own uneasiness? And are we just uncomfortable looking at that physical quality of Ron's desire?
Well, is it strange to be loved for a trait that you don't value in yourself, to be found beautiful for something that you see as something that's lacking?
That's a great question, and that's where we need to turn to Laura, who on the one hand feels incredibly lucky to have met Ron. They've recently gotten married. They went to Venice on their honeymoon. It's a very sentimental story on the one hand. But on the other, Laura does have her dark moments where she thinks to herself, could I get a normal man? And she and I talking shed some tears over that. There's a lot of pain for her, as well as a lot of feeling of being fortunate.
My guest is Daniel Bergner, whose latest book is The Other Side of Desire. It is published by Echo. People can be squeamish talking about or reading books about sex, even so-called vanilla sex. Were you concerned about how your readers might react or how the book would sell? Because this is unlikely to be the kind of book that we find on the gift book table.
It is unlikely to be on the gift book table, isn't it? But sure, I was concerned. On the other hand, I felt compelled to do it. It's a sort of compulsion just to try to look at the truth of things, and I felt like what could be more important than looking at the truth of the erotic?
Well, part of your book deals with the science of sexual deviance and of sexuality in general, or of how any of us come to desire what we desire.
Right.
And we come back to Freud with this?
We can go all the way back to Freud, or we can fast forward, you know, half a century or more toward sort of more scientific, more research-oriented approaches to the question. And indeed, although I felt it was very important to tell stories in this book, I also wanted to thread science through. And one of the questions, of course, how do we get to be who we are sexually? And I spent time with, you know, scientists who felt that by taking fMRI images of the brain, we could trace the sources of our sexuality right to the physiology. Others who took a more anthropological, culturally constructed approach.
Well, most people will tell you that the reason somebody becomes a pedophile is because he or she was sexually abused as a child. They'll tell you that a sadist is somebody who was engaged in some kind of abusive behavior when he or she was a kid. a masochist the same. I'm not sure about foot fetishists, where that comes from.
I'm not sure we know about foot fetishists, but I'm not sure that we know about any of these categories. It's interesting. There's a lot of research that would say, to take, for example, the pedophile case, that that isn't about childhood abuse for the most part, and some researchers who are literally trace it to congenital differences or differences formed in the womb that are then imprinted within the brain.
Well, in this case, two of these people, while their practices may be distasteful to some people, Jacob the foot fetishist, Ron the man who's attracted to amputees, it's pretty harmless. And if you can find somebody who is willing to go along with you, that's fine. The other two are a whole other matter, aren't they?
They are. And let me just say one quick thing about Jacob. His story opens the book. He's the foot fetishist. And tragically, he feels so ashamed by his difference, he can't incorporate it into his otherwise very good marriage. And one of the things that I was looking at in the book is how we do or don't incorporate the erotic into our lives. But you're right. The other two stories are much more threatening, and yet I think still
well, one of them
revelatory.
Is illegal.
One of them is absolutely illegal, crosses all boundaries. There's no consent from that 12-year-old girl. Can't be. The other, the story of the Baroness, who's this sadist, very disturbing in some ways. On the other hand, sometimes led me to some profound place. I was with one man who talked about when he was with her having onion skins peeled from his psyche. And I thought, okay, even though I don't want to be subjected to the pain that he embraced, I certainly would like to have onion skins peeled from my psyche, you know, in sex.
Well, the Baroness has created an elaborate persona, which is very different from the sexual problems that the men face. They are people whose impulses seem to control them.
They are, and there's certainly a sense for all of these characters of being controlled by forces that are overwhelming. That's yet another reason I was so interested in these cases, because although we may not feel the erotic quite that strongly, I think we're nevertheless always on the edge of that, and they kind of represented that, the power of that force.
Well, three of the four people you write about are men. Do you think that men are less successful in suppressing or repressing socially unacceptable sexual impulses?
This is a really fascinating area of research. It seems, emphasize seems, that men are more prone to, let's say, alternate or outlying forms of sexuality. But one wonders whether that's sort of a product of cultural expectation. If you think about exhibitionism, men go to jail, women are asked to dance on the bar.
They make videos.
Exactly.
But when I think about people who have sex with underage, others who are underage, the female school teachers who have sex with their students seem motivated by feeling rather than sexual compulsion. I'm not sure that's true with many male pedophiles.
So this question just brings up something that's so hard to sort out. Is that old trope, men are driven by a sort of physical and overwhelming quality of desire, women by emotion? You know, there's a lot of debate about whether that's really true, or that's an accurate division between the genders.
So men and women are pretty much the same, and yet if you look at the people you talk about, and I suspect if you did a study of people who are out of the norm, you're going to find a much higher percentage of men than women, aren't you?
Much, 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 much higher.
And maybe this is a hardwired thing as well.
It could well be hardwired. It could well have its evolutionary antecedents. This is the profound mystery. It's probably not going to be solved by me today.
Well, there are approaches to dealing with some of these people. I don't know whether what happens to a pedophile, but isn't behavioral treatment applied generally to people to get them out of these compulsions?
I think all kinds of things have been tried over past decades. If you look at the case of child molesters, you'll see behavioral approaches applied now, just kind of more conservative behavior modification and control emphasized in the groups that I worked with. And of course, there's a lot of debate about whether things really can change. It does seem that they can, but you know, the desire is still probably embedded.
Well, what happens with Roy, the man who is a pedophile in your book?
Right. I mean, he's a one of the things that was so compelling to me about his case, a couple of them. One was that he was so very introspective about what he'd done. Two, he'd had no prior record, has had no reoffenses since. So I felt that as troubling as his case was, and his victim was 12 when I during the time I was spending with him, my own daughter was 12. There were a lot of dark places to go in investigating that story. But it did sort of illuminate both the continuum of desire that we all exist upon. Very hard to draw lines of black and white dividing us from Roy. And then it allowed me to kind of tunnel inward and try to see, along with Roy, you know, how he'd gotten to where he'd gotten, how he'd stepped over those lines.
Well, we don't trust people like Roy. There was an article in Today's Times about a town that doesn't want a pedophile who is some, I guess the priest claims that he has, he's not the man he was before. But recidivism rates are pretty high with pedophiles, just as they're pretty high with rapists, aren't they? They have this itch that has to be scratched.
There's, again, a lot of debate, probably an important distinction to be drawn between those who are truly in preference drawn to the very young and those who, like Roy, probably have a pretty wide range of desire and step over that line, in his case, once.
What would you say to people who might find all of this very offensive?
I would think there's a block there, a defense, an unwillingness to look inside. I mean, you know, this is scary terrain because, of course, the erotic leads us in places we don't expect, takes us to kind of anarchic, potentially chaotic and destructive terrain. That's why we as a society spend so much time regulating it, either legally or culturally. And yet it is so central within us. I would say put aside the offense and look.
Well, there are people who get upset by writers of fiction who try to get into the mind of a serial killer or a sadist. And we've had big cause celebs as a result. We are uneasy at even thinking about what might be going on in the minds of somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that was important to me was to write about these four characters, not just in their sexual lives, but in their entire lives. So I was drawn to the Baroness because she was also a very intricate and successful clothing designer, to Ron because his photography seemed to me so powerful. I mean, these are human beings, and this is, you know, a sort of very human drive, and that's what was driving me.
Well, since your books have often been about extremes, are you running out of extremes?
I don't think I've run out of extremes quite yet. I still think I can find a few.
I was going to propose a few, but then I thought it would be too upsetting to my listeners and even maybe to me. But I want to thank you so much for being with us. Daniel Bergner, who writes for the New York Times Magazine, as a staff writer, author of two books of nonfiction, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, which was a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the Year and winner of the Overseas Press Club Award and a Ulysses Award for the Art of Reportage. Also, God of the Rodeo, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. His latest is called The Other Side of Desire, Four Journeys into the Far Realms of Lust and Longing. It's published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Leonard.